Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Now, today, welcome, Amy. How are you today, my co-host?
I'm very good. I'm happy it's Friday, actually, so, as yes. I'm sure all our listeners are.
I reckon. So am I. Okay, we've got, we're going to be talking to two people, Eva Sheerlink and Trevor Pierce, and we're talking about Indigenous Superannuation Working Group Report. And this is pretty serious stuff, and it's about time it got some serious discussion. And some recommendations coming out because, as you know, our people, First Nations people, are 15 to 20 years short of lifespan. And that means we're unable to get to, to pick up your super or long service, stuff like that. And it's been largely neglected and ignored by government. Now, people have been talking about it for a long, long time. Welcome back to Let's Talk, and we're about to, talk to Eva Sheerlink and Trevor Pierce, who are members of the Working Group for Indigenous Superannuation, and they've just come up with a report and some recommendations. Eva, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks, Tiger. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. What is your capacity in this regard? Are you a member of the Working Group? Do you have other official or formal capacities in to do with financial literacy and stuff?
Yeah, so my day job is that I'm the executive manager of governance and leadership at an industry association for superannuation funds. It's called the Australian Institute of Superannuation Trustees. Mm-hmm. And our members are all of the not-for-profit super funds that exist around Australia, which includes the industry funds, the government funds, the public sector funds, and some of the corporate funds as well.
All right, all right.
And I'm a lawyer by background, I'm not a financial counsellor or financial planner.
All right, no worries. We'll just introduce Trevor Pierce. Welcome to the program, Trevor. How are you?
Good, not bad for a cold day in Melbourne.
All right.
Quite nice up in Brisbane today, so I feel you.
It is quite nice here, overcast and a little bit of a light rain, but it is quite nice. Trevor, tell us your country, please.
My mother's country is Wurgamilaroi, so Coonabarabran up to Moree. On mum's side, and on dad's side, we're Wiradjuri, so we're west of Dubbo, out to Warren and Ningen and the flat countries of New South Wales.
All right.
Trevor, you're also CEO of the First Nations Foundation, so that's an organisation that helps our mob with financial literacy. How much has this issue around superannuation come up in your daily work or amongst your clients?
Yeah, look, we've noticed nationally that there's a trend within the community to show a great interest in their superannuation, and that's increasing. I think it's an issue around sort of my generation, that getting access to super and the entitlements around super are increasing because of the age difference between Indigenous Australians and non-Indigenous Australians. So the onset of ageing illnesses, you know, life expectancy is lower, and, you know, super is there. It's your savings. So community have shown a keen interest in accessing that to deal with their needs.
Eva, within the sector, how much of an issue has this been? Has it only been relatively recently that the sector has actually cottoned on to this being a problem for one section of the Australian community?
No. The problem has been, I guess, keeping up the momentum on the issue. That's been, unfortunately, a bit of a challenge. So I know that there were people within the industry who did try to sort of raise this issue and bring about some solutions in the past. Unfortunately, you know, these things sometimes depend on individuals who are really motivated and really passionate to do something, and when they move on from their role, from a particular job or something, you know, the project might die with them. So one of the things that I guess we're now very keen to do through this Indigenous Superannuation Working Group is to bring together enough people who are passionate so that if, you know, a key person does leave, that the project can continue on and we can, this time around, get some real solutions for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
You just released a report, pretty much it was the outcomes of a summit that the Indigenous Working Group actually had just recently, Indigenous Super Working Group had just recently. Can you tell us a little bit about that summit? Was it the first of its kind, or the sort of the history of the working group?
Yeah, that's right. The summit was the first of its kind, and we were pretty proud that we were able to bring about 90 people together from a range of different sectors. So we obviously had the superannuation industry represented on the day, and then representatives from Indigenous organisations as well. But we were able to bring along a range of different government agencies who either have an interest in superannuation, who regulate the superannuation industry, or who have data about the Indigenous population that would be able to help in the work that we do. So our working group was set up about 2 years ago. So ASIC's Indigenous Outreach Program had been, I guess, going out to communities and finding out from people in community that there was this increasing interest and awareness around superannuation, and we're being notified of all the challenges that existed. ASIC then reached out to the industry and said, you guys should get together and own the issue and do something about it. And that's how the working group was born about 2 years ago.
And Trevor, I read a little bit about your speech or your presentation that you did at the summit, and you identified a number of barriers towards blackfellas accessing super. And it's not just the fact that we die earlier, is it?
No, I mean, every Australian has a problem with their super. You know, it's easy to get into super, it's hard to get out of super. And for our mob, it's exacerbated by a range of issues. It might be language, yeah, it might be just basic literacy. And, you know, I've had to deal with my super in the last year or so and sort some things out there. And I struggle, and I live in a city, and I have access to computers and phones, et cetera. Imagine what it's like for someone who's in a remote community. You know, English is a second or third language. So there's some real barriers for our mob and challenges. And it's a lot of people just throw their hands up and give up.
Yeah, I mean, how would, when you're just looking specifically at super as a siloed issue, I mean, it's something like you're talking about problems with identification and problems around cultural competent, you know, workers coming in and being culturally competent. I mean, that's not something that you would even solve just looking at a super issue.
There's no consistency, as Eva said. As you might be dealing with someone sorting out your super within your super fund, and then it's they're away, or they go on leave, or they get promoted, and you've got to tell the story all over. And it's the same old bureaucracy, and you've got to tell the story all over and over again. And that just exacerbates the problem for our mob. And people never get stuff resolved. And some of it can be easily resolved. It's not so much we need to, you know, overhaul the whole system. It's how do we create a process for the most vulnerable in that system. It's not about creating a separate system just for Aboriginal people, but it's how does the industry respond to the vulnerabilities of our mob. And it's about access. It's about good access. It's about the industry being culturally competent and understanding that when they have an Indigenous client, you might need to spend just a little bit more time to sort out that issue. And put some support around that.
It's very interesting. You're talking a bit about it affecting a certain generation, and I would tend to think that that generation, you know, when you look at the history of Aboriginal affairs, when you look at just the scale of the equal wages scandal, the fact a lot of blackfellas who now would probably not be having trouble accessing super were traditionally people who grew up under Protection Acts or who had their wages regulated or protected. I mean, how do we deal with that history as well? Is that a problem?
There is all that. There's, you know, some of our mob just weren't registered when they were born. You know, I was one of those. I didn't find out till the 1980s that I wasn't registered with birth, death and marriages in New South Wales. And, you know, it was a process for my parents to get that sorted out for me. You know, I know a fellow from the Pilbara who's in his 40s, and, you know, mum just got up and walked out of the hospital, didn't fill out any forms. So, you know, but he wasn't registered at birth. He'd been paying taxes and superannuation his whole life, you know, the money'd be going out the door, but now he has to prove that he is actually that person. So there's that complexity. Sometimes it's just simple things like the T in a J, you know, some of our community members' spelling of their names is incorrect. And one of the things that the industry requires is it has to be, you know, we're making sure we're giving this money to the right person. And that's where our mob get caught up in some of the difficulties around that.
Trevor, the issue of a will must come hand in hand with super?
Most definitely. I mean, a lot of Australians don't name their beneficiaries, and then you can put a binding agreement around who your beneficiaries are with your superannuation fund, and that needs to be strengthened, I think, around... You know, getting that down in black and white, so that when you pass, you know, your wishes are going to be dealt with as you want them to be dealt with by family.
It's essential. Yeah, it is essential to have.
Otherwise, it just goes into public trustees, and that's just a long, drawn out other process that people get caught up in.
Yeah, and wills are very complicated as well. I mean, I think there was a study down in New South Wales a couple of years ago which actually shows Blackfella communities sometimes can be divided with wills because you often don't have the same family systems. You might have an auntie who raised you, and if that money goes to a public trustee, it brings up a lot more trauma, doesn't it?
It does, and it does. It's just one of the new things, I suppose, that our mob haven't had to think about in the past, but now they do have to think about. And the sooner we get on the front foot of that, the easier that's going to be for us as community. I think this generation is perhaps in a better position. It's the backlog from our generation that we need to get our act together too.
Would it be fair to say that a will is only essential if you have assets, if you have super, if you have maybe a house, but you must have assets really because.
Well, yes, and I would say yes and no, but you know, some of our mob are because. No one's done a will or no one's named a beneficiary. I know within my family there's a situation where they're still in court today and it's perhaps 5 years later.
Mm.
You know, and that family don't need to be in court fighting over trivial stuff like that. You know, it's what you put into place for your mob to, you know, to get the grieving process done and to honour you. And it's really sad to see.
My question is, I suppose, is it really worth the while? Is it worth the time? Because it is time-consuming. And
I guess
it is
it's a morbid conversation. People don't want to think about it. You know,
but, Amy, there are people, like my mother, for example, passed away 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Didn't own anything. Not a motor car, not a thing. No will, no need for a will. Why go to the trouble of filling out a will when you don't need a beneficiary for anything?
Yeah, I suppose that's true. That's you know, I'd agree on that. That front.
That's just one of the issues.
Yes, it's one of the issues. It's complex.
Eva, you know? You got a comment on that?
Can I say something around the wills,
please.
If that's okay?
Yes.
The way that the superannuation system is actually set up, your will does not affect what happens to your superannuation unless you actually say on your binding death nomination that you want the executor of your will to be responsible for splitting up the assets that might sit in your super fund. It is the role of the trustee. So every superannuation fund is set up as a trust, and there are trustees, a board of trustees, that is responsible for looking after your money while it's with the fund and also responsible for giving the money to your beneficiaries in the event that you should pass away. And it is the trustee's decision to decide who your beneficiaries are. So if you don't have a binding death nomination on your superannuation fund form, it is the trustees who will make the decision.
Right.
And there are some laws around who your beneficiaries are, and this is where there is a significant problem for some Indigenous people, because they don't, our existing law doesn't necessarily understand or... you know, the way that cultural relationships might exist within communities. So it's more about the nuclear family, the non-Indigenous nuclear family, rather than the relationships that might exist in Aboriginal communities.
Like Trevor already acknowledged, the extended family networks, what have you, being brought up by your granny or by somebody else. I mean,
even de facto,
that's what with other children,
de facto.
De facto, and children from another marriage, what rights do they have, and stuff like that, you know, that all needs to be recognised, I suppose, and dealt with.
Yeah, you start to realise how complex the issue is when you delve into it. Eva, there was a point, I think the summit had actually come up with a list of sort of points that they'd like to have rectified by 2020 in relation to super, and I thought... the one was interesting, I think it leads into what we were just talking about, was developing super as a vehicle for intergenerational wealth rather than individual wealth. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how super could potentially be used to, because I think that's been a lot of problems within Aboriginal people, is building that intergenerational wealth?
Yeah, well, I mean, the stated purpose of superannuation is to provide for people in their retirement. But obviously when you have life expectancy issues in the Indigenous community, that purpose may not always be realised. So I think we have to recognise that if there aren't going to be changes to the law in relation to when people are able to access their super, then you have to realise that... you know, that superannuation money is more likely to go to the family members than it is to the person who's been saving for their retirement in their super. And that's what we mean about it being about intergenerational wealth. Certainly when you hear some of the sort of more popular debate that's out there, you know, for the rich people, there's a lot of superannuation talk for people, you know, who've got lots and lots of money in super. The reality is that the majority of people just don't have that kind of money, whether they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous. Most Australians are low-income earning people. But, you know, the idea is that it will top up in some way your age pension. Should you live long enough to be able to access both the age pension and your superannuation money? If you can't, then that money still belongs, obviously, to the family and should provide for the family.
Does this report overlap into pensions? Because, again, like as you've stated, and as we've known for a long, long time, too many of it, we claim that the age for claiming a pension should be much lower, in line with the life expectancy of our mob. If it's 15 years shorter, well, pension should be adjusted. The age for to qualify as a pension should be adjusted. Does your report go into that at all?
No, it doesn't. It is just purely focused on superannuation. But I guess we all recognise that when it comes to retirement, it's not just about superannuation. It's also about the age pension. But this report specifically doesn't deal with it, no.
Okay. How do you suggest we deal with that one? What should our mob do? Because we've been talking about it for 20 years or more.
Yeah. Well, I think representations need to be made to government. I think they're very aware, obviously, of the gap that exists and the fact that the system isn't fair for Indigenous people when it comes to something like the age pension. And I agree that something needs to be done.
Mm. Now, what about the situation with these latest statements by the federal government, who introduced newly structured CDEP, but no superannuation payments. How do you feel about that?
Look, personally, I feel very strongly about that. I think if you're going to make people, work like anybody else, they should be entitled to a portion of that money going into their superannuation to provide for them in later life. I personally feel very strongly about that. I know that the board of the Australian Institute of Superannuation Trustees also feels that it is not fair to make people work and not give them the same rights as everybody else.
Now,
superannuation should be paid.
Yeah. I've lost my train of thought there. Over to you, Amy.
Thanks for that, Tiger. Trevor, I was actually just going to ask you a little bit more about the fact that a lot of blackfellas, obviously, you know, we do have many communities who, because of an access of opportunity and employment, you know, may work for the dole or are on welfare payments for a very long time, for a very large part of their lives. Mm. What happens to their super then?
Yeah, so, and this is the complexity of it is that, you know, some of our mob will have more than one super. You know, over time they've worked for different organisations and it's been, you know, short term, or it's been, you know, in the case of CDP, you don't get any super, which is applaudable, you know, in any standard, as Eva said. So mob end up with a range of super. You know, they could end up with four or five different super funds, and it goes into what, after a period of time of them writing to you and you not responding, and so you sort of go as a missing person, your super is deemed to be what they call, you know, inverted marks, lost super, and that money is then shuffled off to the ATO, and it's held by the ATO. And it's up to you to identify that, well, actually, that's my super.
Yeah.
For it to get that back. So, you know, you've got to open a MyGov account, you know. You've got to then identify, you know, who you work for or the super fund, if you've got any paperwork on that. And it's a complex process to find where your lost super is.
Yeah, and
particularly
if you're in a
remote area, a remote community.
You've got no coverage. Like I said, I
no internet.
I struggle in the city to do it. Imagine what it's like for some of our mob where, well, computer literacy isn't, you
and
know,
some of the
really
issues.
Well.
Some of the issues here are moving the moving around.
Transient.
Yeah. On average, most Australians have about $3,000 plus in lost super.
Wow.
Mm. You know, so what does that look like for our mob? You know, and, you know, where, you know, there's little buckets of money here and there that are all over the place. And if it's been in the super fund and they've been taking out fees for insurance, such as your disability and your income protection and your death insurance, well, that's been whittled away as well.
That's been, being whittled away.
You know, so...
And it's more complex where there's no will.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
A person can pass on, can pass away,
so what has had
a job and has been paying into super contributions have been made, but they haven't got a will. They pass away there's issues there with family trying to make these claims.
And prove that that's, you know, their relative, et cetera.
Exactly.
And there's a, you know, once again, it's complex. And that's why, you know, First Nations, we do things like big Super Day out in Redfern last year where we told industry we the community need them. So, it's, you know, they volunteered their time, their staff volunteered their time to come along to the community. It's not a sales pitch, people. Leave your hat at the door. You're not selling your superannuation products. You are a superannuation expert. Sit down... you know, with a community member and help them sort their super.
What is that First Nations Foundation?
Yeah,
what exactly is it? Who set it up?
You know, we had 170-odd people come on the day on a Saturday morning, pouring rain, and people just, you know, walked in with boxes, you know.
What's that organisation, Trevor? Like, who set it up? How's it been set up?
So
who
we
funds
set
it?
Up in 2006 around this very issue about where do our mobs sit within the financial services sector? What are the challenges? What does industry, you know, whether it be banking, whether it be insurance, whether it be superannuation?
So this is an industry organisation, is it? First Nations?
No, we're a community-based organisation. We're a non-for-profit Aboriginal organisation.
Okay.
So we're based here in Melbourne. Yep. We're based here in Melbourne, provide a national service. So we run a financial literacy program for our mob.
Is that how it's funded? Or did you get government funds? How do you get funded?
Well, we've had government funding in the past, but you know, with this current government, it's been a bit challenging for all of us.
We've got
some support from industry. We've got some support from superannuation industry as well as the financial services sector. We get a little bit of money out of government, so we're like everybody. We're scratching around.
Eva, I read in the report 70 to 80% of financial counsellors' work is actually dealing with people's super. So a lot of time is spent from a financial literacy point of view actually around superannuation. Do you find a lot of financial counsellors don't understand the complexity of the Aboriginal situation?
Yeah, when we found out that figure, that it was, you know, taking up so much of their time, I have to say that we were really shocked. Yeah. That, you know, superannuation was such a, you know, such a highlight issue for them. And we're very aware, I guess, that, you know, the financial counsellors themselves have lost some government funding. And so there's, you know, the demand for the services doesn't go away, unfortunately. You know, and so they've got to do more with less. And having a good understanding of superannuation, I guess, is pretty important. Look, I think probably Trevor's better place to talk about sort of, you know, the skills and training that's available to them. But we are committed to trying to help certainly where we can to, you know, provide them with greater education around superannuation. And on the other hand as well, trying to simplify the processes that currently exist within the Superfund structure to make their lives easier to help their clients.
Trevor, do you think there's the workforce, Aboriginal workforce, they're capable of financial counsellors to actually deliver these sort of services? We talk about an absence of other workforces like health and law. Mm-hmm. What about finances?
I mean, look, we have 70, just about 70 across the country.
And blackfellas or a mixture?
There's predominantly blackfellas. I'd say 80% of that 70 is blackfellas.
Mm-hmm.
We got, you know, some white fellows that work in Aboriginal organisations, or they work in sort of, you know, St Vincent de Paul or Anglicare, and the majority of their clients are going to be Indigenous. So we include them in the fold as well, because they're working with our mob. So it's about cultural competency and getting them involved. And but as Eva said, funding's been lost in the last budget.
Yep.
So we had people that, were told 3 weeks out of Christmas that they weren't, because of no funding, they weren't in a job. You know, so they're in their own sort of hardship basket. But they are the first port of call a lot of our community go and see around superannuation.
Yeah.
And the level of frustration that they, as Eva said, is about knowing the industry and knowing the language and knowing how to navigate that. Some are really skilled at it now, so we're looking about how can we provide some professional development around our Aboriginal financial counsellors, around giving them some skills about how to navigate the system.
Yeah.
But also the industry needs to recognise them. If you're a financial counsellor and you ring up any bank or financial service product, and if you're calling on behalf of a client, you know, they are bound by law, those financial institutions, to listen to what that financial counsellor has to say, because they're a paid advocate on behalf of that client. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen in the superannuation industry.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I think we need to look at seriously about where financial counsellors sit in there, because they can bring to the table quite a lot of support in resolving some of these issues.
All right. Let's take a short break and come back. Eva, I've thought of that point I was going to make in relation to superannuation and CDP. While the government says no super to be paid, they will claim those statistics as being employed. They will claim those on CDP as being employed.
Yes.
But not
that's
good enough
true.
To get super.
Well, they can eat it too.
Oh, of course. Well, look, we'll be back. There's a short message here and we'll be back soon. Our guests today, Eva Shearling and Trevor Pierce, talking to us about superannuation and a report that was handed down. These guys are on the working group, Indigenous Superannuation Working Group, and it's really good to hear this information, to see that this report is out and identifying issues that we as First Nations people have been talking about for 20 to 30 years or more. Let's hope that this report doesn't gather dust like so many other reports do. Welcome back to Let's Talk. As that little information piece says, talk to somebody. And again, that's a key issue here when we're talking about dying. And I mean, we've got to talk about dying too. I mean, too many people are freaked out by the thought of dying. But with the thought of dying comes along, well, if I got any assets, well, how do I distribute it between my 45 kids or my 45 grandkids and 10 children and 45 grandkids or whatever? There's a whole range of issues that come into play for us as First Nations people who have a shorter lifespan and who have to deal with issues like superannuation and claiming for pensions. Over to you, Amy.
Trevor and Eva, this was an issue raised in the report, and I'm not sure if it's an issue that a lot of blackfellas actually think about, but I often have a problem with it, and it's the superannuation funds who are investing in sort of fossil fuel industries and big mining companies. I mean, is there a way we can... for example, I don't think a lot about my super, but I'm uncomfortable with supporting those sort of industries. What would be your advice if a person didn't want to do that, or how do we navigate around those ethical issues if you don't want to support issues industries around that are furthering climate change?
What are our options, and do we have any choice, any say?
Actually, this is you're not alone in having those feelings. Or that discomfort. So there are lots of super funds in Australia that offer, if you like, a separate investment option. So it does require you to actually have a bit of a think and maybe have a look at the website of the super fund that you're with to see what investment options they offer. So they may very well offer an ethical investment option or another option that it might be a fossil fuel free option, or even things like, you know, sort of options that cut out tobacco companies, for example. So this is becoming more and more an issue for people who are members of super funds, particularly the younger generation as well. There are organisations that specifically look at this sort of stuff. And so there are options out there, and I guess if that is something that's really important to you, you know, have a look at the super fund that you're with, and if they don't offer you the option that you need, there are other funds that you can look to.
Trevor, is that an issue amongst your clients?
Yeah, it is. Look, it is and it isn't, because the priority is I just need to sort out the issues that we've got at hand. Yeah. But what we say to people is that, you know, it's similar to the banks. We need to have a relationship with our superannuation industry. You know, the relationship that most Australians, and our mob are guilty of it too, their relationship with their banks, for example, is that hole in the wall. You know, and that's because banking has changed so much that they've pushed us to the hole in the wall, and now, and they pushed us into internet banking, and they now push us onto mobile phone banking. You know, it is important to remember that you are a customer, you are a client, you know, and you need to have a relationship with your bank, just as though it's the same as superannuation. It is your money, and you know, you need to shop with your feet. If you're not happy with the way they invest your money, you need to be asking, well, what are you doing ethically that reflects the values that I hold in the way that money is invested? Because, you know, don't forget that money just doesn't just, you know, go from you.
Lay around.
Uber. Yeah, they make money out of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're playing the stock market.
That's an interesting point you make there, because when you think of the... what was it in Pearson's document? $30 billion a year goes into black situations. But just look at black families that are working, or black organisations. There's hundreds of millions of dollars black organisations where money goes into these financial, into banks largely.
Yep.
And we still we don't realise the power we have by putting money into by having our money managed by these banks. The power to go in and talk, to ask questions, to make demands, because in some cases it could be $10, $15, $20 million.
Yep. Look, I think of my dear old mother, who's in her 80s. You know, she only had one account, you know, like most elders. She ran everything into that account, and she had, she didn't have sheep stations, but she had, you know, enough. And I said, well, let's go into the bank and let's talk about opening a separate account. We put it in a higher interest paying, and we just have an everyday general account for you. And she'd never thought of doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
You know, because the bank had progressively pushed her out the door.
Yes.
And I said, well, come on, we're going into the bank. We're going to ask to see somebody. And we went into an office, sat down, and she said, that was so good. You know, I feel like I'm in control of my money.
Yeah.
You know, and this is where our mob, you have the voting power, and it's called your 2 feet. And you need to as a customer, you need to ask, well, what is best going to suit me, and how can you, you know, convince me to do my banking or do my super with you? So it's important for our mob to be on the front foot of that and engage in that and do some research if you can, if you've got access to computer. But you can even ring them up, you know. And they're required as part of financial services law to disclose, you know, what they're doing.
I'm just wondering, I mean, I think it's really interesting talking to both you and Eva about this, but I'm just wondering how we actually raise awareness amongst our own communities. I think it's something we talk about on the ground, but you don't see it. And what you do see, I just think of the campaign, I think it was around a few Australian super funds which used From Little Things, Big Things Grow. And I was always very almost offended by their use of that song. So it seems to me a lot of these sort of, I know that was a super fund, so it wasn't about financial services, but when you see it on TV, it's very white. We don't have these separate sort of awareness campaigns in Aboriginal communities, do we?
No, we don't. And it's something that, you're right, Tiger, our mob really don't realise the black economy of this country, you know, and this is something that I think, African-American society certainly understood in the 60s around the civil rights movement, you know, if you're not going to treat me like a human being, well, I won't shop in your shops anymore, I won't clean your houses.
Well, when they've got the population, they have some degree of economic power.
Garbage, yeah. You know, so it's, we do have economic power, and it's about reclaiming our position in the continent of Australia. We had an economy before our non-Aboriginal people came here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, it's about reasserting our economic power and our economic rights.
And, you know, we haven't even touched on this institutionalised racism that takes place. I mean, the banking industry isn't immune to that. I mean, some of the most racist treatment you'll get.
Come a long way, banks, you know.
Some have, some haven't.
Some have, some haven't. But at the end of the day, they're out to make a profit, you know, and it's about their shareholders. You know, so... And
but still they can do that without racist attitude. I mean, there are situations here. You were in Brisbane here not all that long ago. You can walk into any of the banks in West End and watch some of our mob that go in. And sure, some of them are inebriated to somewhat or a little frustrated and angry over something or other. But just straight away you get this... and then that the next black person that walks in and may not be in a three-piece suit... gets treated as if they're the same way, sort of thing. You know, they're not immune to this racist attitude.
I have some
personal
experience of that. Tiger, I remember I used to go to a bank to pay my rent every week up in Strathpine, and this one teller, she would smile at everybody else. But as soon as I walked to the counter, the look on her face was like, "I didn't want you here."
There you go. Yes, you know.
And I knew what that was like. You know, and that is an issue. It's still so an issue, I think, for a lot of Indigenous people. You know, banks have employment programs. More of our mob are getting through there, helping our young fellas get through high school, and, you know, they have career pathways, and they all have their raps now and whatnot. And it's, but once again, it's about voting with your feet.
You know,
as a black fellow, if you want to look at all those financial institutions, you know.
And being confident to be able to just ask questions, or if we're not, like you said, you take your mum or your nana, whoever it was you took in, you get the younger ones to come along, just like you would do with a mobile phone or a remote for Foxtel box. Pass it to the younger ones and say, here, work this out, and then show me how it works.
Yeah, exactly.
Take them along to be your mouthpiece for you or to help you understand the information that's coming back to you.
Mm.
Eva, just before we go, you actually presented this report to Parliament on Monday. Can you tell us a little bit about how that was received?
Yeah, I can. Trevor was there with me, actually. So we did that together. We also had a couple of other members of the working group from the Financial Services Council and an organisation called Women in Super. So we had six different appointments on the day across, both the Labor Party, the Coalition and the Greens. We got pretty good, support from all different parties on what we're trying to achieve. So there's the goodwill there. Now it's just a matter of can the industry and government and the different government agencies work together to actually effect some change. So, yes, we've delivered the report, but it's like you say, Tiger, let's hope it doesn't gather any dust now, because now it's when the real work starts. Mm-hmm. We've identified the issues, we've identified some of the stuff that needs to be done, and there's certainly more engagement that needs to happen with community for us to understand all the issues. But we've got a lot of work to do now in order to try and make things better.
The First Nations Media Network should be employed straight up, but then who's out there with funding to assist with a campaign? Yeah. I mean, these sorts of campaigns, you see, like Naomi already referred to, a From Little Things, Big Things Grow campaign to attract business and stuff. The government should... who's it with? There are no real winners here with this either, is there? The money just sits and waits for everybody, for somebody to make an inquiry.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I can tell you that super funds don't want that money to continue to sit there, particularly if they know that someone has passed. They want to be able to reunite that money with the people who it belongs to. At the end of the day, that's their job.
I know we're based in Brisbane. We go all across the country. I mean, Trevor, do you know what are the main... Who can people contact if they do have questions about super?
Certainly they can, Well, first of all, you should speak to your superannuation fund. They usually have, toll-free numbers that you can call. There are the Aboriginal financial counsellors, and there's quite a large network across Australia with that. And you can go through Financial Counselling Australia to find out where a local Indigenous service is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's a great service in far north Queensland, ICAN.
We've talked about those a few times.
They provide financial counselling on a national level through a toll-free number. There is that out there in community.
We've certainly got to be talking about it more and encouraging and assisting and supporting people to deal with it. Mate, we've got to wind up.
No worries.
We've just run out of time. Eva, thank you very much. And Trevor, thank you. Great work.
Thank you.
Just have a good day. Thank you very much. That's rather interesting, Amy.
Yeah, I've got to get my stuff sorted.
Employers like Bima, we have an obligation to talk to staff and make sure they understand so that they can take it back into their families.
Yeah, definitely.
It's now time for The River Story, written and voiced by Ross Watson.
My people are concerned not to compete against the big three and the 1%. They are too powerful and experienced to take on at their own game. Therefore, according to my elders, the challenge for humanity is not to compete. The challenge is to exercise congenial goodwill in discussion around shared problems. Provided lifestyles can become sustainable and self-sufficient, the destructive colonial system might not interfere. Besides, life is more enjoyable when experienced through the defining elements of humanness. My elders say no grinding struggle is needed, just respect and goodwill. In a discussion and action forum of powerless people, the tradition of consensus could be the vital solution to problems raised by difference. As I said before, my people know the potential for division can be reduced by including relevant opinions of others in decisions. In this way, the process encourages respectful and honourable relations between participants. The element of respect engenders responsibility, which leads to accountability, thus ensuring people reflect on issues and increase the likelihood of reciprocity or fairness in all human relationships, including consensus agreements. These elements in relations allow people to enhance the degree of humanness in their lives and to be spiritual in a natural and practical way. To those not ruled by other people, these are the signposts that measure the development of any society of intelligent human beings. These humanizing traits are from the journey of evolution and define the quality known as humanness. This human quality carries the inbuilt capacity to recognize right behavior from wrong. Yes, the elders say humanness is the important milestone confirming the hardwiring of sociability into the human makeup. Sociability finds expression in behavior as goodwill and respect, which give rise to other humanizing traits enhancing relations. Such qualities are part of my people's ancient stories and songs and are required by law as driving and establishing proper guidelines for all human knowledge and practice. This necessity confirms that human lifestyles need to be compatible with the natural environment. All humans everywhere are well ingrained with humanness. 10,000 years of slavery and brutality by rulers and monarchs has been unable to destroy it, but it has severely compromised the evolutionary standard. Childhood in the US has shrunk to 9 years, a reduction of 25% of evolutionary age, and the IQ levels are said to be lowering amongst populations. So yes, evolution is in reverse, but can be put back on track simply by observing the old guidelines, which can be written into job descriptions in a goodwill economy. This is how my people understand the situation. My elders recall the Miglu still wearing leg chains a bare 2 centuries past. Their earliest memories are of slavery and rulers, yet they have achieved the step to democracy and have majority rule as an important move away from chains and rulers. Many experts extol the virtues of democracy, but do not explain that duty statements ensure it is just a small step away from slavery. Certainly, 1% appear to have lost little power or wealth under democracy. However, elders believe the democratic process gives a secure base to introduce the concept of consensus into the mindset of voters. This is so because it has the potential to allow effective personal representation for all voters on all issues. Many people believe elected governments are proven unworkable and should be scrapped or superseded by an efficient system. And certainly the economy is in default of sanity as well as duty of care. Yes, the consensus process has the potential to make representative government a relic of the past. Humanity does not require competition in any voting for popularity contests. The old principles require cooperation, which increases the likelihood of outcomes featuring respect and congeniality. Simple discussion amongst people is able to identify the most common concerns, and the same process is able to find agreeable solutions. Majority rule is a simplistic method seen to cause upset and disruption amongst children. For adults, such a system cannot avoid manipulation, corruption, emergence of leaders, and warfare. Ecocide has increased under democracy. According to my thinkers, another step is required for humanity to throw off the last remaining shackles of the hierarchical system. The step is easy and involves no grinding struggles against powerful forces, and everyone can understand the qualities required. Yes, Simple respect and goodwill are the most powerful tools available to those who want the children to inherit a healthy planet.
There you go. We must ensure that our children inherit, well, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, for me, I suppose, inherit a healthy planet. It's got to be done. I see, Amy, best price, because she's the best price a government could ever get, because there's a sense, word in the community on the ground in the territory that she would be the minister that's got very little outcomes, very little achievements, but has said very little, done very little, talking to people in the territory. That's the word I'm getting from up there.
All right.
This is the best price. And now she's running around with Rosie Batty demonising black men for being woman bashers, wife bashers. Yes, we have some that are, and yes, mainstream, the mainstream dominant culture has a lot that are, some that are. Look at the churches and things, I mean, the abuse of children. So outside of that, we've got men who do, and women that do, abuse their partners.
Although, it doesn't help, I think Rosie Batty,
woman, best price, demonising us, because we're copping that from the mainstream, from white media and white Australia, have that impression. Here we've got somebody coming along endorsing that view, someone, one of our own mob.
Well, I think Rosie Batty, I have a lot of respect for her,
Well, sure.
And I think hopefully, because I think the problem with the current narrative around family violence is that it's so white. It's very much focused on white middle-class women or upper-middle-class women. So I'm hoping that Rosie Batty, when she visits these communities, she comes away with more of a enlightened view and not just one that blames black men but also understands the complexities of the issue.
News is with us. We'll try and get hold of Rosie Batty. Have a great day.